Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What's good, Internet? It is Monday, September 25th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. You're broadcasting from all over North America, mostly the parts from, like, the middle eastward, though. I'm Austin Walker joining me today, Patrick Klepek.
Half a voice, but I'm here.
Half a voice. Rob Zachney also here with a full voice.
All the way from the Atlantic seaboard.
Oh,
in the
boy.
Heart of America.
Yep. So, Rob, no coastal elites here.
What happened to you after the podcast? Like, can we get, like, an update on like, your drinking situation? Like, what occurred to Rob Zachney post-pod?
Okay. I'd had a day.
Yeah.
So I was out in rural Massachusetts and ended up trying to find a place to grab lunch. My partner really had a yen for sushi, and we ended up in a restaurant that we were familiar with, but they found a new location, and it was the most tragic, like, basement hellhole we've ever seen.
You don't want basement sushi.
It was also full of day drinking country club types who were, let's see. In addition to loudly inquiring after each other's meals and then making fun of its Asianness, then they were also sort of, you know, just sort of rubbing their hands with glee over the impending destruction of North Korea.
Yeah,
and all the good things that their boy in the White House is going to sort out for America. So it was a very MAGA lunch. And then I needed to walk in a forest for about 2 hours to calm down and get my blood pressure back under control. The day of merriment kind of came to a screeching halt and had to be sort of put back on track. One quick thing I will say, though. So regarding the Imperial Beverages line of beers and ales.
Uh-huh.
I'm starting to realize it's not my fault this keeps happening. It's
famous words.
Yeah, this isn't me. This is a structural issue with American microbrewing. Like, remember 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, it was all like, everything's an IPA.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be hoppy as hell. Like, do you love hops? We're just going to fuck you up with hops.
Get hopped.
That's the old meta.
New meta.
Yeah. So now,
e-sports.
The new meta is, what if beer, but imperial?
Oh my god!
And so, I was at a liquor store, and I really don't drink as much as I used to, so I haven't really, like, marked this shift as much as I might have noted a few years ago.
You haven't played since version, like, 2.0 or whatever,
right? So I'm coming back into it, and there's, like, all these new heroes, and, like, I don't recognize them, and I'm looking at these giant bombers of beer, and they're all imperial, high alcohol beers, and so it's actually become a little, not tricky, but, like, your selection is limited. If you just want, like, a good beer, just a good sip-in session, everyday hangout, like, crack open a cold one with the boys, that is impossible. Because every beer is like, you want to get real drunk real fast? And I'm like, maybe not. And it's like, I got you, fam. Don't worry about it.
It's 2017. I'm not going to hold it against anybody who is like, I got to get real drunk real fast. I don't have time. I opened up my phone today and it said someone in North Korea is like, oh no, we're at war, actually. Actually, that thing he said is basically a declaration of war. I gotta get that Imperial Stout in me now, Rob. I don't have time to sip on anything light.
I can't wait for an actual nap to arrive, so I need to force the issue with my body.
Well, guys, the American beer industry then has you covered. Like, they anticipated where 2016 would leave us, and now that's where the beer industry lives.
God, it's good to have the update. Thank you for our weekly sip and sesh with Rob Zachney.
Anyway, now I've got Scott.
With Rob.
Now you've got scotch. Good. Happy Monday, everybody. Scotch day. Have you been up to, Patrick? Have you also been spending the weekend walking through the woods and getting angry at Trump supporters?
Not the Trump supporters. I get angry at the balls that I shank into the woods when you're playing golf. So like that feels a little bit similar. I channel my energies into I had a golf outing with some family this weekend, which I won.
Do you name your golf outings?
Yeah, well, it's the Clubic Open. It's just
okay. Is that really what you? So my family, it's like they do four. They do four majors a year. Like they play whenever they can, right?
Lord.
But my dad and his brothers get out there at least four times a year for the majors, which is like the Walker Open, the Walker Classic, the Walker Invitational, and there's a fourth one that I can't remember. Hey, Dad, by the way, Dad's listening. So shout outs to my dad who won the Classic that year. There's a trophy and everything. It's a whole thing.
We have a plaque in which the winner each year gets added their name. So what's going to happen next year is that my handicap is going to be adjusted because we adjust the handicaps in a very severe fashion to try and average out because we have a lot of people that are pretty good. And then some people that just want to hang out or like come visit family. And so we don't want to discourage like the inability of someone that isn't very good at golf, but maybe has a good day or like a couple good holes that they may not win, but they'll like be in the middle of the pack. And then someone like me, who's like pretty average, but ended up having like a pretty decent day, like my handicap dragged me to winning. So the next year, my handicap will get adjusted in a way that probably puts me back at the middle of the pack. And then you just got to practice.
You got to work on that swing, man.
Man, I won one year. I'm done. I'm never playing golf again.
Your name's on that plaque.
I'm on the plaque. Like, and it was super funny when we did the math and it was announced that I'd won. There's just a lot of sighing because they're like, wait, Patrick won? That says a lot of bad things about how we played today. Like, no clapping for me. No, like, hey, good job.
Buddy.
Like, you've really put in the effort over the last couple of years. And the fact that you were pretty decent, despite the fact you just had a kid this year and you still managed to play, like, that's good. Like, no one said it was just outright disgust that I'd managed to make it to the top. So I'll take it. I'll take it.
Yeah. Listen, you got the name on the plaque. That's all that counts. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the Klepek tour is pretty serious. Austin, are your dad's majors just like him and his brother, or
it's
like
just him and his two brothers? It's him and it's my uncle's Tim and my uncle Larry and my dad. It's three people, and it's very serious. The Invitational, I think, historically had some wiggle room for additional people, but like if you were like not there to play for real, you would come on just one of their regular weekend outings. They're like, "Oh, it's a nice Sunday. We're going to go to whatever the Maze Landing golf course and play there." No one in the world knows what Maze Landing is. It's a very specific regional location in New Jersey. Just like not a major golf course, just like an alright little golf course. And
the Augusta of the Turnpike.
That's what they call it. You just go for that. But like, there was definitely always a vibe of like I played with them a couple of times, I guess, when I was like a teenager. I was terrible. I was like completely garbage. And they were very good sports about letting me hang. But like, I would never go to a major because they take it super seriously. They work on their swings all year. They have like back pocket strats. You know what I mean? Like, they're ready to pull out some shit that they haven't shown off in those regular weekends for the majors. They're like, you didn't know that I've been working.
Golfing is not fun to be bad at for extended stretches of time. Like playing, if people have never played golf before, well, I guess people are now more aware of how long it plays 18 holes because of Trump. But generally speaking, if on a good day when a course is like moving fast or there aren't that many people, like you can do 18 holes in like four and a half hours. If it's a busy day, you're looking at like five or six, depending on how it rolls out. And so like, that's a long time to be miserable.
To be bad.
And like I took my wife one time, she was like, I want to play in a course. Like, I don't want to just do like the range and just, I want to see how it is. And I was like, 18 holes is a lot to bite off.
Just
like,
that's do nine, man. Just
and
do,
I had,
just.
I took away her clubs at hole 14. I was like, you're done.
You're was she just in a bad mode? Like, what happened?
Well, yeah,
like,
she was starting to throw the clubs. And I'm like, okay, you're done.
Well, you're
done.
Yeah. Okay.
So I gave her, I gave her like this little tool I have to fish out golf balls from the water.
What?
There's like a little a scooper that you can like.
Yeah,
put
no,
in your...
I'm familiar with the principle.
Okay,
right, but
so
you took away her clubs and gave
her
a tool
to steal people's golf balls.
It's not stealing if you hit it into the water. If you were any better, then your ball wouldn't be in the water.
Jesus Christ!
So then she got me like 25 balls. It was a productive afternoon for all involved.
Great. Good. Good and great. Oh, man. I had more golf. Golf courses are weird because they are huge. They're just huge. They're huge. And mostly for rich people.
Yeah, like, it's a waste of space. It's
a terrible waste of space.
Historically, the most privileged of sports?
Yes. Right? Historically super racist, super anti-Semitic, sexist. I definitely have always taken joy of just like being on a golf course with my family, with my black family, and be like, no, we're here now. Y'all have to deal, actually. That's always been a joy. But the thing that bums me out about them is like there's a version of golf. There's a world in which golf is not a waste of space, or where it's like a public good, and I think that version is just like there are better parks everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, I love golf because I like walking around outside. I like golf because it's not like basically any other sport. Like, I'm gonna hit this ball really far, and I'm hitting in a direction, and there's lots of places where it would be successful if it landed, and there's lots of places where it would be not successful through the first few hits, and then like it changes for putting, where it's like the opposite, where it's like there's only one place that I need to get this ball, and if I get it anywhere else, it's a fuck up. I love that duality. Like, there's a lot that I like about it as a sport. It just is like buried in this terrible history of land ownership and racism and, you know, imperialism, and it's fucked. But also, I just want to, like, when it's time to for the revolution to come, I'm going to put those the fucking they're up against the wall first, and then I'm going to turn every golf course into a public good. Also, I'm making the choices in this scenario, which is not also going to happen. I don't think EICs last very long either these days.
Definitely not a chance. The journalistic intelligentsia ends up before the firing squad. But you know, when I worked at that horrible golf course ages and ages ago, I think my favorite part about it, like speaking of the park aspect, was like at the end of the day, after I'd sort of finished up my shift and everyone was off the course and off drinking in the clubhouse and becoming even more the boorish assholes they'd been during the day, like the course was empty. And what I loved to do was like just, you know, I would ride the cart out to the distant part of the course where there was like this little like tiny peninsula into this water hazard between three holes, and there's a weeping willow on it. And it was just like the perfect place to like just sit down and be utterly alone in the silence of that, like basically a park at that point. And it was just gorgeous. And I lived for that. It made the, you know, miserable pay and the lousy shift and the lousy people, you know, kind of worth it. Cause at the end of the day, you're just sort of sitting there, you know, smoking cigarettes and
reading and or whatever
alone in the park. Yeah. It was great.
Oh, that sounds all right. You guys want to take the rest of the day off and just go hang out on someone else's golf course?
Hell yeah.
And not play. Just no. Like, hey, can we pay $60 just to like walk around your
Just
course?
To walk around? I got an iPod with me. I'll just put on some music. Shit. Like, I'm just trying to have a good day. I shouldn't say that. Like, New York has some really good parks. I could just go to Prospect Park or Central Park or like any of the other really good parks in my city and do that there. I should just do that. Not today, because Danielle is still in. Oh, Danielle just got back actually from Scotland, but is still off today. Sounds like she got into a fight on a plane, which is good.
At least she's equipped for it.
She's equipped for it. And from my reading of her breakdown of it over on her Twitter, it sounds like she was in the right, and it was good that she was there to de-escalate things.
It was very. It was like nonstop. But Danielle.
Right. Exactly. So, oh man. So it sounds like neither of you played any video games over the weekend.
I played a ton.
Oh, you did.
I thought you
lost in the woods or whatever.
Yeah, but then I came back and I played video games and discovered that games are good.
Games are good. I played a bunch of games this weekend. Way more than I thought. Way more than I have in forever. What did you play, Rob?
So I finally got around, very belatedly, to playing a game called Shadow Tactics.
You messaged me about it this morning. We're like, Austin, you should play Shadow Tactics. Please.
It's urgent. Austin. Play Shadow Tactics. I need you to play this game so we can talk about it, because it reminded me a lot of like Samurai Satellite Rain.
Ooh, is the way I would that's put a good it. Comparison.
Like, yeah, not quite as busy in terms of like an open living city, but
sure.
Like guard behaviors, right. A really brilliantly evoked and realized setting in feudal Japan, where you and your sort of A team of ninjas and samurai and hunters.
It seems like it reminded me of the Commando series a lot from what I looked at it. Is that a fair comparison? Do people remember what Commandos is? No one remembers what Commandos is. No, tell me what Shadow Tactics is.
Well, so we talked about it on 3 Years Ahead, and it is a lot like Commandos, but I never played Commandos.
So I got a lot of shit from
Fraser Brown and such about not seeing that comparison. But it is like, so it's a real-time like stealth tactics game, isometric perspective, and what you're trying to do is, you know, you're going into a mission. You have to like maybe kill 4 officers, part of this rebel faction, and there's political intrigue in the background. But most of it's like you're in this environment. There's guards on patrol. There's different classes of guards with special abilities, and they react to different ways, different stimuli. Some guards will run to any kind of distraction lure. Others will like just like be alerted by it, but they actually won't react to it. So it's not in your favor to try to use that stuff. And then your team is, it's a bit like Invisible Ink in this regard. Your team members all have different abilities. Mm. And so they play very different roles. There's, you know, your samurai character is much more like the heavy. Whereas you've got this sort of, you know, feral child who's basically like made her life in the woods trapping and thieving. She has like no combat ability whatsoever, but she has a lot of different ways to pull people into different locations and like set traps for them.
Right.
And so you kind of like a lot of it is about seeing the ways you can sort of synergize these abilities and use them to open up paths through the level. There's also a lot of environmental stuff that you can use if you pay attention. So like, you know, if there's a, you know, if there's a boulder on a trail, for instance, there's a decent chance that at some point someone's going to walk below that boulder.
Oh, you just push that boulder on them.
Oh, hell yeah.
Classic ninja move.
Yeah. And guards react different ways to like a natural death. They're alerted and suspicious, but they don't like immediately sound like call for extra guards.
Right.
Whereas if they find like, you know, somebody lying in a pool of their own blood with like 20 holes cut in them, then they're going to be like, yeah, we probably need the guards out.
Right.
The big wrinkle is that, so most of it's real time, and reflexes count for a little bit, in this game, but to really,
it's like an isometric map view, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can rotate the camera around and get a better perspective. And guards have really long vision cones, so it's a lot about like knowing what's going to be seen. But the more advanced stuff you can do is called it's called shadow mode. You can queue up one order for each of your squad members, basically, but they will execute when you hit enter. And so you can like have these really intricate, like, you know, you hit enter. And somebody sounds the lure, which causes a guard to turn around and look away from where your samurai is stepping out and like putting a sword through someone's throat. And then you as a player have to be like who you're going to control during this sequence to take advantage of this momentary opportunity. You know, because you can't queue up multiple moves, so you have to like know what your next play is going to be on the back of that.
And it's like what's really, the thing really that cool. You could just automate and you know it'll work versus the one that you need to be the one who hits, who like does it yourself, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm watching a video of it now, and there's this moment of just like you queue up stuff in shadow mode where it's like one person is like kind of a character who can just distract guards by walking up to them and talking to them, while another one like is a sniper up on a hill who has like an early rifle and who is waiting for that guard's like head to turn the other direction so that they can get a clear shot without being seen or whatever. That's really cool. This seems good. I would like to play this game, this video game.
Yeah, it's I can't believe it took me so long to get around to it. I think it came out like at the end of last year.
Right.
A console version just came out not too long ago.
Oh, how do you think?
I'm not sure how well that works.
I just watched a bunch of video of that game. That game didn't look like something I would play with a controller, so.
Seems like that would be a bit of a reach.
Seems rough. But
nevertheless, it's totally, I think, up your alley. And the other thing is, it's just got a lot of great thematic flavor. The Japanese voice acting is fantastic. Mm. It's good, serious, grown-up anime and not like, you know, school children, you know, it's not one of those, it's not sports anime.
Okay, it's not shonen. It's not just like, all right, but listen, what if it was, and what if it was just a Naruto game? That might be okay. Also,
I don't know
not
that
a big,
it would be.
We should see it. I'm just saying, I'm putting it out there. Shadow Tactics 2, now it's Naruto. Now it's Naruto. That's what they're... It's coming. They just got to do it for me. That's the mod. Thank you. Someone mod that, then I'll play it. That's it. I played a game that was pretty interesting also from that also had some stealth angles to it that was really stressful. It's one of the most stressful games I've played in a long time. It's called Echo, all capitals. It's by a team...
Some ex-Hitman.
Yes, exactly. An ex-Hitman. X-Men. No, the
about
X-Men.
A killer
did not...
dolphin.
Exactly. It is a really cool... it is a really stressful game. Like, the thing I want to emphasize is how, like, terrified I was while playing it. So this is a game I've been watching for a little while and had, like, I was very cautiously optimistic about it because it has a really great premise. It is a sci-fi game in which you're infiltrating a place called the Palace to do some sci-fi shit. At least that's what the trailer showed. And the big pitch on the trailers was that the Palace is this weird sci-fi construct that paid attention to whatever it is you did. So if you were... It's a third-person action game like Hitman or something like that, like a third-person shooter. And so if you ran around killing enemies... The enemies who are AI constructs made to look like you would then start to shoot you. They'd learn how to use guns. If you were doing silent takedowns, they could learn how to do silent takedowns. The trick of it is they can only learn what you do in the light, because the whole palace works on this cycle of light and darkness. For the most of the time, the world is bright and lit up by these chandeliers and these sconces and all this other stuff in this very, like, Versailles-style palace, right? And then when on a cycle, the lights go dark, everything gets hard to see. And in that moment, what's happening is that the palace is starting to reprogram the AI to learn what it learned from you, but it also means that they can't see you then. And so what I ended up doing, or kind of what the trailer kind of suggested, was like, oh, that's when you pull out the gun, because that's when no one can see you, or when the palace can't see you anymore, and so it can't learn to can't teach its soldiers to use guns on you because you did it in the dark. What doesn't come through maybe from that is that, like, it's all terrifying no matter what it is they're learning, which is fantastic. Like, there's a moment when it drops you in pretty early in the game into a room filled with water and then little islands of kind of dry palace flooring that are raised up a little bit. And you just, like, run through that section because you have to go flip a switch to go open a door and blah, blah, blah. And so, like, as you run through the water, it makes the noise and does the kind of, like, shadow effect to show that the palace has seen you walk through water now. And so because of that... Once the lights come back on, in the first bit, all of the guards are just stuck on these islands of floor. Like, they can't come after you in the water because they've never run in water before. And because you've never run in water before, as far as they've seen. And so then, like, the lights come back on and suddenly they're all charging at you through the water. And it's, like, a really great moment. But it also has made me, like, a deeply conservative player in terms of what I'm willing to do. I played through the first hour of the game without killing anyone because I was like, well, maybe they won't attack me if I don't kill anyone. They'll attack you still. They'll still, like, do the one basic attack. I was like, well, maybe I'll get an achievement if I don't ever kill anybody. And, like, you can't play the game that way, because the other thing that it didn't hit me until only very recently while playing is it unlearns things too based on you not doing something in the next cycle. So, which is a really good twist, right? So it's like, if you do a silent takedown heavy cycle, it's going to learn that for the next run. And then you can use your guns, because then it won't know how to use guns, and you can use it there. And then it will sort of, maybe then you cycle back the other way to start doing silent takedowns again. And it's about kind of managing what it knows based on what you just did. So, like, in that water section, I think a thing I could have done, now that I understand this, is I could have let them run at me. I could have run through the water to go flip the switch, waded through a cycle so that they wouldn't try, like, and hidden, so they would forget how to run through water, and then run through water on the next cycle again where they've forgotten how to do it. I think that's how it would work. I'm not 100% sure.
That's a fascinating way to tackle that problem we've discussed around Dishonored and the way they build their DLC, which is to build in different sort of powers and...
Yep.
Structures to try and force the player to ditch previous strategies, or at least encourage them in a different direction. But most games just kind of nudge you, and sometimes it's kind of a push, but it's never a shove, or it's never like an explicit box. And I think I'd be curious how that would scale in a game that was bigger. I wonder if, like, it can get away with it because it's sort of a tinier, more, like,
yeah,
focused experience. But I like the idea of, like, explicitly just, like, taking away avenues from mm-hmm. the player and forcing them to then come up with alternative strategies. But
exactly.
putting it in a, like, very... Like, it's fascinating the way that the game is upfront about how it's an actual mechanic. It's not just, oh, they're, like, going to kind of learn it and it's an adaptive
right.
AI.
Right.
It's like, no, like, there's an actual, like, there's a consequence to your actions and it is communicated in the UI, in the environment,
yep.
in the
yep.
art. Like, that's
yep.
a really interesting
and
way to...
And in the dialogue directly. That's the other thing about this game that I didn't expect. So, like, what I expected was I'd be dropped into the palace. There would be, like, very loose story stuff, like, very, like... Based on seeing those early trailers, I thought the whole pitch was the premise, which was just like, oh, you're going to be infiltrating a spaceship that looks like a palace or something, and you're there to rob something and get out, right? And, oh, no, it goes bad. And, like, there is an element of that here. But what I didn't expect is, like, the first hour of the game, the first 45 minutes, I'd say, are this, like, super cinematic, very stylized, very, like, prestige sci-fi. I guess something like... The movies that come to mind when I think about this first 45 minutes are things like Ex Machina or Gattaca, or like it's more high science fiction than that, or more
yeah.
science fantasy than that. But like, you know what I mean, right? Like
right.
the very stark shot composition, very like lots of silhouettes. And then the writing is this mature model of science fiction that you don't see a lot of in video games. You see it a lot in literary sci-fi. You see it a lot in sort of crossover, kind of like art house sci-fi film. You don't see it in games that often. Like there are two main characters. There is this character who you play as named N, who is like E-N. She is like... From what I can tell, like, there's all sorts of... First of all, Rob, you need to play this game just for all the capital... All of the proper nouns. She is a... Not a reclaimer. She is a resourceful. There's a class of people in this world called resourcefuls that I think are just bougie. They're just rich people. They're like rich people, but also she's kind of a millennial in this weird future world. Like, she's not actually a millennial, but like there's a lot of this like the only person she speaks to is this like bratty, kind of like snarky AI who's like this older British guy. She's this younger British woman in voice. And he's just like so judgmental about her and her young youthful ideals. And she is like, she had inherited some fortune, but then is like anti-capitalist or anti-authoritarian basically. It's like a very, there's lots of pausing in the dialogue. There's lots of like weight to every line. And they're chemistry on screen I think is super good, and it was not something I was anticipating at all. And so through that you also see them working out how the palace is working.
This game looks so stripped down
yes.
that I figured like, okay, so it's mostly going to be a wrapper around a game mechanic.
Well, I think it is that now. That's the thing. Is like, so I'm a couple of hours in. I think it has now become that. But there is still lots of really interesting story stuff happening around like what her job is, what she's trying to achieve here, the history between the two of them and this third character who is only ever talked about in reference. But it's all done in this. Again, this is why I'm comparing it to kind of prestige sci-fi in a film or kind of literary speculative fiction and science fiction, because it is really a character work. Like it has its concept, like a lot of great like sci-fi novellas. It has its premise, which is like, ooh, that's an interesting premise. And then that premise is a vehicle for really good characterization. And in this case, really interesting gameplay mechanic. I need to put more time into it. I've only put in like, you know, a couple of hours so far. I think it's only like 5 or 6 hours long. I kind of hope, because I don't know that I could do, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's 20 hours long. I don't know. But I don't know that I could do this for 20 hours, because it is really fucking stressful. It is really hard to be like, I only have limited resources, I don't want to show them new tricks, I don't want to like overextend myself. And it's just scary. It is just like also a scary game to be chased by clones of yourself. Like, this is not a fucking good look, like to be choked to death by, also like the faces in this game just don't look great because it's a small team, presumably. Mm-hmm. And it just adds this really uncanny level, because everything else, the palace looks so good. The palace just looks so like pristine that the faces having this uncanny element, like are maybe it's a choice to do that, but like, it's weird. It's like a, it is a heavy thing. I really do want to know how long this is. Now that I'm going to go over to How Long to Beat, the games journalist best friend.
Website.
Shout outs to How Long to Beat, which tells me, do I have time to actually do this thing? Mm-hmm. No one has completed this game on How Long to Beat. Thanks. Ugh. So that was the thing that I've played. I actually played that just before the last podcast and didn't get a chance to talk about it. But I really think both of you should check that out for sure.
There's no games coming out anytime soon. No, so we're just kind of that to the list.
Dry period, right?
This not really, it. Actually. Like, Golf Story comes out for the Switch this week. That game is like this little...
What is that?
It's a golf RPG. It was shown at the Indies Showcase. It looks...
Oh, shit.
Like a modern kind of Mario golf RPG sort of game.
That's been my problem with the recent Mario Golfs is that they haven't been RPGs.
Yeah, so it seems like Golf Story... I emailed the dev, and he said that they were still aiming for end of September, which would
be... Oh, I'm going to play this game. Holy shit. Patrick, this looks good. We were just talking about golf.
I know.
Rob, look at this game. There's a graveyard. There's a tropical island. There's a boat.
The new game from Runic Games, Hob, which has been bouncing around for a little while, that comes out tomorrow. I didn't know that game was this year. I didn't
Hob
know it was anytime soon.
Torchlight, right?
Yeah. Hob's the game. Runic Games made.
Sorry, Runic. Torchlight. That's what I meant. Yeah, Hob is the new game from Runic. From Runic, who made Torchlight
and 2. And they make cool stuff. That comes out tomorrow.
What is this? What is this game? What is Hob?
I don't know, but I know that Runic Games make it, and I like their game. It's like a platformer type thing.
Yeah, this looks cool.
Something.
Yeah.
And then I just got a code in my email for A Hat in Time, which is new, like Banjo-Kazooie tile, ukulele style. Well, maybe not, hopefully not ukulele style. 3D platformer that was kickstarted and fumbling around. It's, you know, it's a very explicitly N64 style.
Yeah.
Sort of 3D platformer, Rare sort of stuff from in the 90s, and it looks really good. I don't know if that means it's going to be good, because Ukulele looked good, too. Mm-hmm. But,
this looks better than Ukulele to me. I'm not going to lie.
I'm not that dude, but yeah. Yeah, they put this little GIF in the email with the code, and it has like some traversal and movement mechanics that look really, really fun, like in a way that N64 platformers were pretty slow by design, and it seems like Hat in Time gives you a lot of like verticality and speed to go like getting around these giant environments. So anyway, yeah,
SteamWorld Dig 2 just came out.
SteamWorld Dig 2 came out last week. Like
Battle Chasers and Night
Warhammer 2 just came out.
Yep,
yeah,
totally.
Battle Chasers comes out next week.
Shit. Yeah, I'm still have to
Project
play more
Cars
Divinity. 2. Project Cars 2 also just came out. That's true.
Right, Divinity like a bare minimum like 80-hour game.
Yeah, I put more hours into that over the weekend with Janine Hawkins. I'm doing that in co-op mode and had a better time with it over the weekend than I did last week. But it's 80 hours. Like, I don't know if I can commit that sort of time. I don't know.
I have already scratched off Divinity as a 2017 game for myself. Not because that's Divinity's fault. It's just like to maximize the investment. Like, that's like I'm hopefully going to play that over the winter. Like it also is a game I would enjoy more when it's cold out.
Right.
And like I'm spending more time inside and I don't have the option to go do other things. So.
You know what's out tomorrow?
What?
Ruiner is out tomorrow.
Oh, right. That looks very good.
I haven't played that. I've seen that at PAXs, at E3s. I've seen that for 2 years now and I've never touched it because I've been like, oh, I'm going to like this game. I'm just going to wait to play it. Fuck, man. I started to play, here's like, let's go the opposite way. A lot of these games that we've just described have been like big budget or at least like mid-size indie game made by teams and like commercial. They've been very commercial games. I played a game called Dujana over the weekend. I didn't finish it. I put like an hour into it. It is by Jack Kingspooner, who did Sluggish Moors and Blues for Midavinda a few years ago. Work to compare it to would be like Space Funeral by the Catamites. Maybe some of the Arcane Kid stuff comes close. Like very like a handful of people made the game. I'm pretty sure Jack Kingspooner makes all of his own games all the way. I think he's a one person studio, I believe. And it is it's just like a very unique looking thing. It's a game that I haven't seen anything else that looked like it except for other games by him. It has a very like, there's lots of claymation. There's lots of like the characters are just made of pieces of clay. It has like a really wide range of audio elements, in the sense that like it can be like this really pleasing to the ear music playing, and then just like a ridiculous screech will like make an entire area of the world like uninhabitable for you. The basic premise is that you are this mom in a vaguely Middle Eastern, like not fantasy Middle Eastern, but like surreal Middle Eastern setting that is occupied by like U.S. armed forces, and that has like giant spider people who are also just shitty internet form trolls, basically, who like kidnap people, and your husband and your daughter go missing, and you're trying to find them. It is like a very strange game. In terms of like in comparison to most commercial products. So like I want to just put that up front. Like if this sounds like, oh, and then you get into like battles, like no, you're not getting into battles. Like it is an adventure game. It's it's a kind of an exploration game. You're exploring these environments by like walking around them with WASDA and hitting X to talk to people. But it washes over you in a really, pleasing is not a complex enough word. Like it is very intriguing, it is very engrossing. Like it's all, when I was playing it, it was all I wanted to do. Like I wanted to turn off all my lights and just like let this thing happen to me so that I could like really just let it like embody that moment of being in it. The soundtrack is incredible. Also, there's a giant robot, but like it's a giant robot that just helps you. It's like an oil digging robot, basically, that lets you fast travel around parts. Not fast travel, but literally like walk faster than you can walk. It's a very funny game in that like you're like, oh, I'm like my daughter and my husband went missing, and your mom is like, you should go talk to Sam and see if he'll loan you his keys to his old oil mech to help you go like look around.
You know,
just go talk to Sam. It's very funny and but also very like thoughtful and weird. Jack King Spooner is I believe is Irish, and there's like a moment when you're walking around this Middle Eastern world or like this Middle Eastern inspired world, and you find the U.S. UN camp, basically the camp that the occupying camp, and you just go into one of the buildings and there's just a U.S. podium, and if you go up to it and hit X, like hit the activation button, it takes you to like a teleprompter with Trump's speech that he gave while he was in Ireland. And so there's this like double layer that I'm working to unpack here, which is like, okay, this is obviously very much about like the various wars in the Middle East over the last century, over the last 50 years, like since World War II. But also there is definitely just this notion of like, there's definitely an Irish politics to this, despite the fact that it is not taking place in Ireland. And I want to kind of try to work through all that and unpack it. It's only a few hours long also. And it's also just like very quirky, like for something that is often very heavy and very hard to like be in, because it is purposefully oppressive. It is also just like has moments of very good lightheartedness and like internet humor, but not bad internet humor. Do you know what I mean? I guess that's a thing that I like more. That's one of the reasons why I'm eager to watch Neo Yokio, is like I like internet humor, but I don't like shitty internet humor. Like here's one. You meet a soldier in the occupying camp, and you talk to him, and he goes, after a long period of reflection, I decided I was right yet again. And it's like, yep, twitter.com, there it is. The woke gamer says, after a long period of reflection, I decided I was right yet again. Perfect.
It's a good line. I gotta write that down somewhere.
Yes, it's extreme. And then like there are fake fights where you get into like a random encounter, and then you just target something and hit X, and then it says something like, the spiders find the presence of a smelly girl terrifying and run away. Item, salt of the earth. Item, no arms, no legs. Medical advancement, super babies. Bold claim learned, bigot. Learned spell, morphine porridge pump. You learned French flipper trick. You learned scrappy doo-doo. The team has been offered a free estimate for a new kitchen. New ability, bark. Upgraded all wizards. Like, alright, good. Yep. And it all like just scrolls past really quick, like the end of a Final Fantasy fight where you just get 1,000 things.
Awesome.
Yeah, exactly. It's very cool, and I'm like glad I made time for it, even just to dip into it, because it's one of those games that's like, oh, this is selling on itch.io for $7 or whatever. It would be easy to miss it this year or this season when it's so busy, but like it was a nice break from these other much more, you know, big budget, like going from Destiny to Dejana is like a very hard swing in terms of like, oh right, games can do all this shit. Games can do a lot, and I have room in my life for both of those. So that was a nice little bit of extra fun this weekend. I also played a bunch of board games and stuff. I don't want to get too deep into it, but I beat the Netrunner Legacy game. I've mentioned Legacy games once or twice before, which are games like board games and card games where they change as you play them. Rob, you've done at least some of these, right?
Oh, I hate those.
Do you? Why do you hate those?
I fucking hate them.
Hang on, they're my fave.
Okay, I think... Yeah, so it's like there's a huge central board, right? And there's like sideboards and the cards work their way around them and there's like collective challenges. Is that it?
No. Okay. No, this is the thing, like, this is like the...
Legendary, I think I'm thinking of.
You're thinking of Legendary. I'm talking about what, like, Rob Davio did with Risk
like
and
changing
Pandemic.
Games.
Yeah,
changing
like
evolving
games.
Board games.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, like, Rob Davio did this, I'm pronouncing his last name, right?
Yep, you are.
With Risk years ago, which is, like, if you like board games, I don't know, Patrick, what your feelings on Risk are. Have you played Risk much, Patrick?
My feelings are that I don't play board games, but not because don't have time. There's
all
just
right,
a thing that
what
I...
What you need to know is Risk is bad. Risk is a bad board
I've
game.
I've heard that from most... Kind of like Monopoly sucks, too.
Yeah, I think Risk is, like, a bad way to spend time. Mm-hmm. But Risk Legacy is, like, you know, Davio... was like, okay, how do I make Risk interesting? And the way that he did it was he made it so that instead of playing one game of Risk and that was it, you play a bunch of them and the board changes and there's almost a sort of narrative that occurs around like the state of the world and parts of the map change. And like now this place is a big city. Now this place has been nuked to oblivion. Now there are, you know, weird armored bear units or whatever.
And the players are making the choices
about how this world evolves.
Yes. So it's not like it just by game six, this happens and it's this like prescriptive way. It's like somebody decided, I'm going to use one of my nukes and hit this province to take it out of your hands.
Right.
But now every subsequent game has that nuked province.
Right. Exactly. And so the one that I played over the weekend was Netrunner Terminal Directive. I'd started it last week and then wrapped it up over the weekend, and it was really cool. Netrunner is a two-player card game. It's a cyberpunk game in which a corporation is trying to score agendas, which are things like writing their name in the side of...
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The moon, or mandatorily upgrading all of their employees with cyber eyes, which are bad things. But there's this time. The whole game is basically the evil megacorporation wants to do something bad, but it needs time and resources to do that bad thing. And in the time before they can score those agendas, before they can like put the resources into those agendas, the runner, the hacker, can hack in, find it, and then kind of show it to the world and be like, yo, this is fucked up, and they haven't built the spin for it yet so that people won't think it's fucked up. And that's already really cool. Like, I think Netrunner is like one of the best games ever made, full stop. Like, it is like 100% from a design perspective and from a fiction, from the way the fiction interacts with the design, from the way that, like, you can tell stories through it. Even just the regular game is really good. But the kind of legacy edition version of it, Terminal Directive, literally tells a murder mystery through a series of like six games. Or maybe, I guess it could go up to like 10 games probably, but we wrapped in about six. In which a replicant, basically a bioroid is what they're called in this universe, basically a replicant, starts killing people, and they're not supposed to be able to do that because they have directives programmed into their brains. And so you play as a corporation who's trying to track it down to be like, yo, we have got to put this thing under wraps. Like, no one can know about this. And the runner is working with a cop who used to be a hacker to try to find the truth. And it's a really cool modification to what is already a really fun game, because suddenly you're doing things like in the middle of – you get objectives where it could be something like if I'm on the corporation side, I could get an objective to like destroy a bunch of stuff that the runner has, like a bunch of programs that they use to hack into my stuff. And if I can pull that off, which sometimes means changing my deck so that I can pull that off, then I might get new cards or a new effect goes into play immediately in that game and going forward into the next few. It's a really like it zooms out the kind of play space in a way that's really fun. And it also just works as a great like tutorial to Netrunner, because a lot of the objectives that get into put into play, or a lot of the restrictions that get put into play over the course of a bunch of games, basically train you to do smart things. Like, I'm going to spoil one thing, and I don't like to spoil things from games like this, because half of the fun is that there's all these packages that say, like, don't open this. Do not open this until this point in the game. But one thing early on in the runner side of the campaign is like, if you don't do a run every turn, if you don't make a run, if you don't try to hack into the corporation every turn, at least once, then a bad thing is going to happen. And so for Jack, who is new to playing Netrunner, my friend Jack, who I was playing with, that was just like a good way to get him into the habit of being aggressive as a player. Whereas normally new players, they're like very cautious. They don't like hacking, because even though the game is about hacking, they don't like doing it because it's risky. But like, it was a really cool way of teaching him, no, you have to do it. So that was a fun thing I did over the weekend. And then I also put the finishing touches on Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, which I've been playing on and off with various friends for years. I talked about it at length in an old Beastcast. You should go look that up if you want to hear about Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, or I've written about it a few times. Just search Austin Walker Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. If you want my feelings on that game, they're out there. I promise. They haven't changed. It was cool to wrap up this thing that I've been playing on and off with various friends for like 3 years now. So I recommend that game always as one of my favorite board games. So that was my game filled week. You guys didn't, or Patrick, you didn't play any games this weekend, but sounds like Rob and I had you covered.
Thank you. Can you cover all the other parts of my job? And I'll just take a back seat.
Yeah. What happened
nap,
today?
Take a scotch nap.
I got a new story. Here we go. I mean, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, typing. So turns out that 10% of Steam players are playing PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds now. It's a headline.
Meet the game that 10% of Steam players are now playing.
Oh, Rob, that's...
Oh, it's getting there.
That's not bad. That's a good rough draft.
I mean, actually, is that... We're working on that piece about the players, right? Rob?
Yeah.
You've edited that piece?
I asked you if you wanted me to edit it.
Yeah, you should edit that piece.
Let's peel back that curtain to our Trello. A tumbleweed blows across the Trello.
Yeah, let's edit that piece and use that headline. 10% meet the players behind the game that 10% of Steam players are playing.
Well, we'll work
right now.
It.
That's it. That's the one.
Nailed it. It's got lots of SEO. People, I mean, that's... like playing and players.
People love playing and also players. We should do the like the rock paper shotgun or PC gamer style thing, which is like players ball : meet the game that 10% of Steam players are playing and why they love playing it. Done. Ship it. God, headlines are bad. Internet headlines are hard. It's hard to write a good headline.
Cuphead's out this week too.
No, it isn't. Stop it. Ugh, that's too many. That's too many games. Ugh. All right, you know what I'm going to do to adjust our games is I'm going to pivot this podcast into the question bucket.
Yeah.
And it is see if there's anything nice and lighthearted here to help us to think positively about this very busy time in our lives. All right, this one comes in from Andrew, who says, fuck.
Great. Dear Waypoint, well chosen, Austin.
Dear Waypoint crew, it has come to my attention that Nazis are organizing a march in my hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, on December 28th of this year.
Jesus.
This is highly frightening to me that something like this is happening in my hometown. I am afraid to say that what happened to Charlottesville, protesting the event could be dangerous for both me and my girlfriend. Granted, for the rally to take place, the CMPD, the police department there, still must grant them a permit. At the time being, we can we can call an email to prevent a permit from being given. I will give links at the bottom. Since I know what to do to try to prevent it, what steps can I counter this rally if it does end up taking place safely and peacefully, coming from someone who has never protested before? Sincerely, Andrew. It seems like the good news is that this group in question has not yet filed for a permit. He sent us follow-up. So that's good. I'm glad that they've like not done not taken the step necessary to actually do this. We actually talked about this in a past episode in terms of like preparation. Maybe we could even include a link out to like some basic prep protest prep stuff in the show notes this week, Patrick. I think Vice has run a story about like, all right, here are like the five things you should know mm-hmm. about. But like one big thing would definitely be to get in contact with other people who are going so that you're not going alone, and to make sure that you have like other organizers who will be able to guide you through that directly, who can provide you with information about things to bring besides just like water, right? You know,
and they may have essentially like a how-to guide. Yes. Like, here's the things that are going to be helpful. Here's the message that our group is sending. Here's the kinds of, you know, they'll probably leave suggestions for messages on a sign if you don't feel creative enough for, you yep. know, for something to come. Like, following the lead of others isn't totally. Like a sign of weakness. That's a sign of like recognizing that other people have experience and knowledge, and that is probably the best way to both know how to like respond if things get yep. weird, if things get violent, if things yep. go any number of ways, is to look towards others who have participated in it before as a guidepost for how to kind of guide your own behavior.
Other things I'd say is like cash, just in case, like in a sock, in a back, like cash and not just cards, just in case you lose your wallet. Like keep cash on you. I'd say keep emergency contact numbers with you, like on a piece of paper, like
maybe
something
not
so
on
that
the phone.
Not on yeah. your phone. And on that list of numbers should probably be some sort of legal counsel number so that you could get in touch with someone who would, if you got arrested for whatever reason, even though you were just protesting peacefully, like having a phone number for you know, lawyers who are there to support protesters would help a lot. Other than that, like, there are guides out for that. I'll try to find one and link one in the show notes for you. So that's one. But the other thing is just like, yes, good. Do the first step, which is get in touch with the permit granting people and, you know, let your voice be heard there. Like, obviously at the end of the day, they may still decide to give a permit to the group. But getting involved ahead of time like that is definitely the right move to do, is what I'll say.
I mean, the thing I'd add is like, just, usually, so like when they came through Boston, for instance, there were multiple counter protests organized, and yep. I suspect the same thing is going to happen down there. You know, and so just sort of consider which group you might want to link up with, because the different counter protests are all going to have a different political agenda as well. So think about like what you want to be standing for mm-hmm. at the counter protest, but then also what kind of protest resistance you are comfortable engaging in, right? So like, you know, if you're going to be in a place where like direct confrontation or civil disobedience, you know, is going to be happening, you're going to be taking part, that is a case where you need to be thinking about, you know, worst case scenarios. Do you really want to have a phone with your personal information on it? But if you're anything like me, and that is that might be too rich for your blood, you know, there's a lot of good protests, you know, that organizations like the DSA will be putting mm-hmm. on, that will be just more about like representing and standing up for beliefs and values and yeah. You know, bearing witness. So, you know, just sort of find the correct demonstration for you and what you want to bring to the table. I do kind of wonder, because the Boston thing ended up turning out kind of comical with mm-hmm. the scale of the white supremacist rally, and admittedly it's a different landscape in North Carolina, and for a lot of different reasons. But at the same time, like, Charlottesville caught people by surprise.
Yep.
I don't think it's going to happen again. And so I think it is upsetting and it is frustrating, but as you get involved in preparing to protest this, I think you might be heartened by it's a good reality check to see that when people know to expect Nazis and white supremacists,
right,
like how popular they actually are versus how many people fucking hate these scumbags,
yep,
and will come out to say so.
It has been really heartening for me this year to see a lot of people who, I mean, like, it shouldn't be like, motherfuckers hate Nazis should be a thing we all agree with and know. Like, oh yeah, fuck Nazis should be, of course, fuck Nazis. It has been heartening. There have been like a handful of specific people where I've been like, oh good, you, okay, cool. Like, you're, yeah, good, you. I shouldn't have ever doubted you. You're good. Awesome. Of course, there have also been other people who have been the opposite of that, who have been like, very much like, there's never a reason to punch anybody ever. Mm. And like, all right, cool.
Well, good. I think what the usefulness, obviously the better situation is that no Nazis, none of this shit, but the usefulness of scenarios like this, in which like it should be sort of like black or white on which side you're on and how you should feel about it,
yeah,
ends up revealing a lot of interesting things about the politics of people you know,
yeah,
which you might have assumed one thing, and that actually,
yep,
you find out that a lot of people's politics are performative and,
yep,
and may hide. In the grand scheme of like the usefulness of the Trump era, the politicalization of people that would otherwise be apolitical or just sort of like coast through, and the fact that people are forced to examine their own politics on even someone like myself who was already deeply engaged with politics, mm-hmm, but then like is forced to think about it in a different context, in a different light, in a different weight. Like, it's again, like, no Trump better than Trump, but like in,
yeah,
the context of our situation, like there may be long tail like self-improvement for myself and like self-improvement for others,
yeah,
which is like examining your participation in culture and like what that means to be political or apolitical and what your definition of what it meant to be political or apolitical was in the past and how that has changed now. That can have useful dividends.
This is part of the question for me ends up being like, I think a lot of this will come out in the long run, if there is a long run, what the net effect of all of this was, because, or all of this is now even, because on one hand, I think you're totally right that there is a degree of activation here of like, oh shit, I have to be dialed in. I can't, we talked about this on Friday's podcast, right? Like, I can't just be an apolitical, snarky asshole anymore. Like, there are, suddenly the scales have fallen from my eyes and I can see that there are stakes now. On the other hand, I need those stakes to be more than it's Trump. I think, you know, there was a really fantastic tweet from The Shrillest. Do y'all know The Shrillest on Twitter? Which was, I'm just going to pull it up. These people who were, fuck, I changed the thing. Here we go. These people who were against kneeling when it was about racism and are for it now that it's a muddy free speech / anti-Trump thing are sus. And like, yup, like the I've seen so many people who last year when Colin Kaepernick was like, oh, he was taking knees, these people were saying, this isn't the right avenue for this, this isn't the right way to address this, or were silent on the issue, right? Who were like not going out of the way to stand up for the dude. But now that like Trump specifically has been shitty about this over the last week, and I know you missed all this, Patrick, because you smartly logged off. A lot of those same people.
Don't worry, but impossible to miss in the last.
Just in this morning, yeah. A lot of those same people are people who are like, fuck Trump, now I'm going to be upset about I'm going to defend the right of black athletes to make political statements on the field. And that. We need to be able to push. We need to use whatever this catalyzing moment is to push people not only to specifically be anti-Trump, but to engage with the things that Trump is threatening and is like at a policy level, at a cultural level, actually be engaged at why people are being politically active and not just we have a boogeyman now.
Yeah, that's the problem with having like a unique existential threat.
Yes,
is that it turns on people in a way that is like being. Being political is very easy in 2017,
yeah,
because like there's plenty for a broad stroke of people to be upset at, and it's very easy to say fuck Trump. But yes, like there will be a certain number of people that activate and sort of turn on as a result of Trump, and maybe like you said, like their eyes become opened. But the true test is like what happens after Trump when things go back to sort of, you know, Obama era. Like, you can just be comfortable. Like,
yep,
things are, you know, incrementally in many ways moving in the right direction, but that can often hide a lot of the shit that's happening underneath, and that also can make you check out in a way that, like, I did my job. Like, I sent the Trump tweets. I signed the petitions. I did one protest, and then suddenly, you know, when, you know, the middle of the road Democratic candidate is elected in, you know, 2024, you suddenly just feel like, oh, that's it. I'm done. Like, I did my part.
I did my part.
The Democrats love to sweep this under the rug. You know, something I've been thinking a lot about this week, I think about it a lot, actually. I've thought about it a lot ever since it happened, was Shirley Sherrod.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a I think Department of Agriculture?
Yep.
Civil servant, lifetime civil servant with the Department of Agriculture, who was sort of one of the first scalps that Breitbart collected under the Obama administration. And what really struck me when that all happened is that the scandal was that she'd in a speech to an African American civic group, she'd basically talked about, thinking about screwing over this white farmer, because he was giving her attitude. And what emerged was that Breitbart, as they always do, had doctored the video and taken it out of context, and stripped out the full story. And what was revealed afterwards is that she'd come around to, she had decided to help this guy in spite of his racial prejudices, and ended up sort of saving his farm and become sort of friends with that family. But what I've never been able to get over is that, one, the Obama administration raced to show her the door.
Yep.
For expressing this. But the other thing is, I always felt like I was going mad during that, because her whole speech is about the life of a middle-aged African-American woman in the second half of the 20th century.
Yep.
She's talking about, I think her father was lynched, actually. But certainly the Klan came and menaced her family, and she has childhood memories of, her mother and grandfather being on the porch of their family home with shotguns, warding off Klan terrorists.
Yep.
And I've never been able to get over what it must have been like for someone like that to wait for someone like Obama to show up.
Right, your whole life you dream that Obama shows up. Obama shows up, and against all odds, against a primary candidate who used his race against him, against a rapidly radicalizing right. This is like the era of the Tea Party coming into being. He manages to get through. He even says it outright. Work twice as hard for half as much. And this is the moment where finally you're supposed to be able to feel like we've got it. And then cuts down 2 minutes of an hour long video.
An avowedly racist website.
Right, yes.
And
a white nationalist website.
Immediately his response is to be like, well, I must show how fair and unbiased and how what a unifier I am, and so I'm going to throw this woman under the bus without even hearing her side. But the other part that haunted me is that I was sort of stunned listening to that speech, because having had the experiences she had through life,
right,
I don't know how you get over that and become a proud American and a civil servant. Like, I don't know how you just like move on from that and decide, yeah, I'm actually going to help this racist
this
farmer.
Poor, right, exactly.
Yeah. And so that's me sort of like missed the real story. And what has become clear in the intervening years is that there is this really terrifying rage whenever marginalized people, but particularly African Americans, express any kind of ambivalence or complexity for their experience of America and their relationship with it. And what is scaring me is, this is becoming like, they're taking a knee against Trump. That's not what it was about. It was about police violence against black people.
Yeah.
And I really worry that if we get through this, it all dies down. We go back to these platitudes about uniting as Americans and coming together, and those are empty bromides, because the reason we're in this boat is we never confronted these divergent experiences. We never confronted the very recent evil in our history, the ongoing evil in our history, And my terror is that the left is represented by people like Obama, like the Clintons, like to move on from all this.
Right.
And just want to get back to the business of things being fine.
Yes.
And if they're not fine, shut the fuck up.
Right.
And we can't do that again.
Right. And the thing that's frustrating is seeing what is an effective method of protest, effective because it brings the issue to the foreground, because for, you know, certainly taking a knee, by taking a knee, Colin Kaepernick didn't bring anyone back to life. He didn't, you know, institute changes in police policies, but he did use a platform to make us talk about shit. To have that then turn into simply a place in which we are able to, like, get one over on Trump. And don't get me wrong, getting one over on Trump is a good feeling. When LeBron James tweets, "you bum," like, God, it feels great. So good. And we need those morale boosters, right? Like, we need that strategically. We need those. Like, I absolutely believe in that. There are moments in political conflict in which the, you know, doing things that don't necessarily bring the other side over can still be valuable because it can keep the morale of folks, you know, who are really struggling and working on our side, keep that morale up and keep, give them energy to keep them going, right? Like, bread alone. You cannot win a war on bread alone, right? You do need that leadership and that energy and that morale. But it is so frustrating to see the establishment, like, capture what was once a you know, relatively radical sort of political action and reformat it to fit a more centrist, a more traditional kind of political position, right? It's very easy to swing at Trump. It's so much harder to unite a lot of people against anti-black violence, especially anti-black violence done by police, done by authority figures, and also anti-brown violence. Like, you know, obviously that there is, it is such a complex position to even get into because of the ways in which police violence are already talked about across racial lines, across lines of income, but especially, you know, this specific history of anti-black violence, and it is infuriating and demeaning to always have that conversation need to be reframed to a wider issue. You know, this is the quote from James Baldwin, right? Which is like, all around the world, white people raise guns in defense of themselves and say, you know, this, you know, this is, he's talking in the 60s, at this point, I think is when this quote is from. Maybe the 60s, I believe it was the 60s, saying, like, if an Eastern European country pushes back against the Soviets, everyone cheers. If you know, if an oppressed people in Western Europe push back against fascists, everyone cheers. But, like, the second a black person says, like, oh, I'm oppressed, what many white Americans say is, shut up, things are equal. Like, work harder. You know, the reason you don't have this is because you don't have it. And not only is there a distinct difference in response, there's a distinct difference in response considering the scale of what that is. The notion that someone taking a knee at the national anthem while the flag is being displayed, which isn't a thing that even always happened in football, like in which the
Stephen players, A. Smith, welcome to the resistance.
Welcome to Stephen A. Smith to the fucking to Waypoint Radio.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I'm telling you, man, I cannot wait for Stephen A. Smith. I tweeted,
but
Stephen
actually,
Day,
it is a crucial point that he's making,
yes,
the other night,
yes,
which is these ceremonies are a fairly recent phenomenon,
yes,
and were in large measure sponsored by the government.
Literally sponsored.
Yeah, to draw attention to, like, the National Guard and serving soldiers, which, yes, was partly to honor them, but also partly to remind everyone that these are objects of civic
yep,
admiration, and that would also presumably boost both the popularity of recruiting and the popularity of the armed services. Like, there was always an agenda here. It was a political thing, and it's not... This wasn't something that Americans always did. This would have struck your grandfather as kind of fucking weird.
Yes.
I mean, the humorous part about all of this is that there are a lot of racist football fans that like to exploit the athleticism of black athletes,
yep,
without actually acknowledging their blackness. And the entire reason that this is even a thing is because they enjoy the sport of football,
mm-hmm,
and the athleticism of black athletes, but don't want to acknowledge the fact that they're black. And the only reason they're uppity about it is because they want
good
you
reversal
to throw the,
there. Good
they
reversal.
Want you to, they don't. They want you to throw the football, but they don't want to They like the fact that you keep your helmet on.
Right,
the
which is
you took that, that always take that helmet been off. The case. Exactly.
And this is like they like it when we were on stage playing music. They like it when we rap. They like it when we entertain. They like it when we tell jokes. Like, and it is
help
it
my
is,
fantasy football, but don't tell me about how you feel about the police state.
Exactly, about what your place is in life. You know, it is. You know, keep it to sports. Just write about video games.
Can we pause? How freaking weird, though, that like this has been. So I see some people saying that like Trump is sort of finding a wedge issue and he's playing three-dimensional chess again. Yeah. I don't know. I can sort of see that point, but on the other hand, the NFL has gone to such extreme lengths to prevent anything like this from ever happening.
Yep.
To prevent any kind of class consciousness from forming.
It's the opposite of the NBA.
Yes,
like
exactly.
The NBA has essentially embraced and allowed the idea that like players, white and black alike, are going to be extremely political, and it's just bizarre to see like if this happened in the NBA, it would just be a blip because the NBA just realized like shit, we largely rely on black athletes to fund these stadiums and to fund our stars, so like we should acknowledge and allow them to express their political speech through like their best platform possible. Whereas the football world has like been very uncomfortable with politics, and so like that is part of why this is as strange as it is and as vitriolic as it is, because it's football, like a sport getting dragged into politics because they've actively avoided it in all instances.
And it has been the thing that frustrates me the most about this stuff is the same thing that frustrates me about people saying that game critics should only stick to talking about whether or not the controls are tight, which is like, no, like just like games, sports have always already been political. We opened this by talking about golf, by talking about the way that golf courses use space, the way that they even in the idealized world, even in the ideal version in which everyone gets access to golf courses as public property, like even in those worlds, that's still space being taken away from other goods, and that is already or other possible uses, which means it's always already caught up in a politics of what we do with our public spaces. Not even getting into the history of racism, of locking down courses to you know, black and brown people to Jewish folk. Like, that is already a history of race already. And that's not even to lean into talking about how many historical figures in the world of sports have been actively political, to, you know, Ali refusing to join the army draft, right? Like, to going to jail over that. Like, there is a history of black athleticism in this country that runs alongside a history of black political activism. And to suggest that somehow that is a new development is, again, I come back to this position of it being in bad faith. Like, I don't know how you go. I don't know how this is an ignorance, and it feels so much more like an active, establishment of alibi. You know, like, oh well, that was different because X, Y, Z, and it wasn't.
But so much of this is just like erased or ripped out of context in the way the history is taught, right? Like,
yes.
I was, I think it was like in my late 20s when I heard about like the Tulsa race riot, which, by the way, isn't a race riot, it's ethnic cleansing.
Let's be very clear about what that was.
Yeah. So, you know, that was, you know, I was reading a book where this comes up, and I was like, that couldn't have happened. This is a work of fiction. Like, this is some crazy bullshit. And I looked it up, and I was like, oh, the white neighbors of a prosperous middle-class black community leveled it to the ground and bombed it and strafed it for a couple days. And that happened, like, within my grandfather's lifetime, for instance. That's how recent this is. But the other thing is, we have this cartoon vision of what protest and activism was, which is this, you know, perfect example is, you know, the Disney-fied Care Bear vision of Martin Luther King, who comes out and says, what if we weren't racist? And
then everyone went, oh!
Yeah.
What if we weren't racist?
The I Have a Dream speech is, wouldn't it be awesome is if on the reddest hills of Georgia, people in Nazi shirts and black people could get along and not punch each other. And everyone agreed that that's basically how it should be, and that's how we beat racism
forever.
And
that's how we did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was absolutely nobody else taking action at that time. And there was...
this was not a unified... This was not a thing where, because through a diversity of action, Martin Luther King's version gained popularity with whites because the other versions made it clear what the... Right, exactly. Like, ugh. all of this stuff comes from history is deeply complex, and there are many actors always, and the way that things change is through diversity of actions. Everything is overdetermined. Everything comes from a number of sources colliding, and like, if in your mind you believe that change should occur, but only through a prescribed, sanctified, cleansed, pure version of political action, you should reread your history books. Like, not to be 22-year-old Austin again, but fucking read more. Like, yes, also that, right. Like, read firsthand accounts. And also read past I Have a Dream, right? Like, read into King's activism around labor rights. Read into King's activism around the Vietnam War. Like, read beyond just the clipped down version of his greatest hits. Like, go to those deep cuts. Like, that stuff has an ideology that goes beyond just we were all born equal, and is about what happens on the planet after we are born, right? Like, that one of the biggest dividing points in political ideology in America is what equality even means. Is it equality of access, or is it equality of opportunity? Is it that we all have an equal chance to achieve something once we're down on the field, or is it that basically, fundamentally, we should all have these things as rights in our lives? We should fundamentally have the right to healthcare. We should fundamentally have the right to shelter. And a lot of people use equality in that other way, which is you should fundamentally have access to a store where you can buy food. You should fundamentally have access to the opportunity to go buy healthcare, regardless of what race you are. And when you really push at what equality means, you need to, like, we really got to know which type of equality we're talking about. And what I want to happen, and I think this is another really great point of, like, going back to the take a knee protest being co-opted by this much easier politics, is that we develop political methods of protest and an awareness of recognizing when what we're saying is, no, everyone deserves a right to healthcare, everyone deserves a right to not be shot by police. We recognize when that protest is being co-opted by that second thing, which is everyone has access to a market to buy healthcare, or everyone is equal, has an equal chance to be shot by police. Like, that is
oh no,
that is the thing that, like, we need to make sure that second step isn't happening, right? Like, it is about demilitarizing police, like, absolutely, but it's also about making sure that there are methods in place for police to be accountable when they perform racist acts of violence, or when you stop and frisk procedures when indexed harm, you know, black and brown people more than white folk, even when the numbers suggest that white folks use and sell drugs just as often, right? Like, those sorts of things need to be addressed directly, and we need to make sure that we have an awareness and a consciousness around what is actually at stake and what it is we're actually fighting for. And, like, so often someone will sweep in and try to broaden it out or make it more universal. And I get it. Sometimes you want to make it more universal so you can get more people on your side to show up to those protests and make a bigger force and, like, shut down the Nazi protests. I definitely understand the urge, but we should make sure not to give in those very specific claims of injustice, those very specific goals in favor of this more supposedly universal claim that keeps the status quo intact, instead of forcing it to adjust to what the real lives of people are, to what the real injustices on the ground are. Whew, good question. We got there. We got into some deep shit today.
Also, call your congresspeople and demand disaster relief for Puerto Rico.
Yeah, fucking for real. Unbelievable, the shit that oh my god, the photos that have come out of Puerto Rico in the wake of the recent hurricane have been just terrifying and sad, and the fact that we have not mobilized to provide relief to U.S. citizens, like, obviously
it seems pretty ethnically loaded to me.
Yeah it does seem that way. Oh man, it has me thinking a lot about the U.S. territory system and the system with Puerto Rico and, like, what we consider ours, and it has been heavy in the world for a while, I guess. And it's so little time. Like, people have been around as people for so long, but you think about the last, like, 100 years, and it's wild. Oh man. Anyway, there was another question that's way lighter, and we should go out on that one before we call it. This one comes in from Maria, who says, "Hey, everyone. If you were to get a video game related tattoo, what would it be? None isn't an option. Death isn't an option. Thank you for your hard work, Maria. What would my video game tattoo be? Sorry, Maria, for making this seem... Maria, I know Maria on Twitter. Maria's a good person. Maria is very politically active.
I don't know. I think you need to re-examine the politics of Maria at the moment.
I just hit next question. I was like, oh, that's a good light one. What would my... The thing is, like, the only game-related tattoo I think I'd ever get is something about the second season of Friends at the Table, which is a tabletop podcast I run. Partially because it was a story I told with my friends, and it's like, oh man, we told this story together by playing tabletop role-playing games. And partially because the message of that show was, like, very political and very, like, leftist and very, like, about making sure that you value your labor and that you're not tricked into doing bullshit for other people. The problem is video games don't often tell us those stories, and so it's hard to be like, okay, here's something I care that deeply about. I think about, like, the games that matter the most to me, and, like, is there anything in them that I would jump to? I know, Patrick, you've talked about Dark Tower tattoos before.
Yeah, I don't know that I have something in video games that, like, I can't even... Like, I was trying to... I was like, there was a Lost video game. What about the numbers from Lost? That's kind of abstract, and you wouldn't quite pick up on it unless... I don't... I mean, because if I was going to do it, like, when I've considered over the years, like, getting something, it would always have to be sort of, like, symbolically abstract in the same way that, like, that's often how I buy t-shirts and things like that, is, like, you have to sort of be in the know to understand what it would be.
Right, it can't just say...
It's not going to be the Triforce, and that's, like, no disrespect to anyone that's got, like, the... I don't think I want to, like, be clear about that. Like, it's fine if you want to get the Triforce or something that... It comes across to me as, like, a little on the nose. Mm-hmm. But I guess even that's symbolic in a way that, like, is in the direction of what I would even consider.
Right.
It's, like, it's something that is imagery that is symbolic, but not explicitly something that... I don't know. I don't have any interest, and I can't think of too many things that would go in that direction.
I'm racking my head. I could conceive of digging through Kentucky Route Zero for something. There are really good logos in that game and names and stuff, and I like KRZ enough to be like, yeah, something from here could do it, but, like, I'd have to really dig. Rob, what about you?
Well, yeah, it's tough, because...
Rob,
like,
do you have a Triforce tattoo? Did I, like, just really make things, like, incredibly awkward?
No, but I was thinking, like, you could get away with the Triforce tattoo just because it's so generic and meaningless at this point.
What if you just got knuckle tattoos that said wisdom, courage, power?
Fuck you.
Because that's the Triforce. What's more political than the Triforce, Patrick? Using the wisdom to see injustice, the courage to face it, and the power to defeat it.
And then you interlace your hands and show them to someone in the struggle. That's Night of the Hunter.
Can this be the Democrat slogan for 2018?
That's it. The Democrat slogan. Just a picture of the Triforce.
But also it's a diamond. There's a fourth point, and that's better skills.
All right, I think we're done.
I think that's it.
That's the podcast.
Thank you for our... Someone did write in recently, like, you guys get political a lot. Is that, like, a thing that you're going to keep doing? I was like, maybe. And the answer was yes.
This podcast was supposed to be, like, 35 minutes long. It's now an hour 20. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon for me, 3 o'clock for you. I've not eaten lunch.
Yep, me either. I've eaten nothing today.
I'm full of politics.
I have a meeting in a minute that I'm not going to make because I'm still in still in Queens. Literally at the end of after streaming Battlegrounds today, the thing I just said was just like, could we hit the podcast real quick? And then Rob was like, oh, like are we going to start in 30 minutes or 5 minutes? And I said 5 minutes. And then internally what I said was like, I'd like this to be over by like 2. And now it is now 3. So, doing it right. I'm Austin Walker. You can find me at Austin_Walker on Twitter. You can write us email that we might read and then go off into a huge political tangent for 30 minutes at gamingadvice.com. Where can people find you, Patrick?
I'm at Patrick Klepik.
What about you, Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
And what about the website? Website, you can find it at waypoint.vice.com.
Answer our questions website.
That's it. You can also find us at twitch.tv/waypoint. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. You can find, that's it. That's all of us. The archives still aren't up yet. They'll hopefully soon we'll start getting archiving our video stuff again. You can also find the track Miss You, which Bowen has let us use for the theme song of this beautiful show, over at waypoint.zone/BOEN. I think that's going to do it for us. I think we've made it out of this. I feel cleansed. I feel powerful. I like said all the words I wanted to say, but didn't know I wanted to say. So thank you, Robin Patrick, for being here and being a conduit for us to like get all these bad vibes out. Hopefully you're going to have a good week. We got lots of games to play, as we talked about. We'll be back on Friday to talk about those. Until then, be good and be good at it. Peace.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.